Thank you, Justice, and good afternoon, Justices and Vice Chancellor. May it please the Court, Christopher Coist on behalf of Joshua Mirabel. This is an appeal of a criminal case in which the issue is whether a conflict of interest that clearly manifested itself during trial is grounds for a remand for a new trial. Mr. Mirabel was indigent, and normally in the criminal context, there's a triage done of all criminal cases in order to identify possible conflicts of interest. It's done early on at the first stages of a case, and typically a determination is made based upon whether there are co-defendants. Under a certain fact pattern where there are multiple individuals that were arrested at the same time. Now, in this case, it's the case is in reference to a traffic stop. And the traffic stop occurred on December 1st of 2011. There were three individuals in the car. One of those was Mr. Mirabel. And the other individuals were a Ms. Santana and also a Ms. Stafford. Ms. Stafford ended up being criminally charged and was represented by the Public Defender's Office. Her case resolved in June of 2012. Mr. Mirabel initially had private counsel who represented him, and he was not able to continue with trial counsel, private counsel. They were permitted to withdraw, and the Public Defender's Office entered their appearance in the case, and I believe that was somewhere around July of 2012.
Now, when was the affidavit signed?
You mentioned affidavit, and unfortunately, the record, there is not an actual affidavit that is on the record or it would have been submitted to the court. There are conversations about the affidavit, what the affidavit would have entailed, but there is not an affidavit that is on record for us to be able to review. I believe what the affidavit outlines is it was obtained by an investigator, Thomas Monahan, which is the reason why Mr. Mirabel at one point in a dialogue with the court is discussing individuals that he wanted to have called. It was either Mr.
Is he a public defender investigator or a private?
No, he is a private investigator that was retained when Mr. Mirabel was being represented by private counsel. So this private investigator met with Ms. Stafford, had her make a statement, complete an affidavit, which was signed.
And notarized?
I believe it was notarized.
But you don't have a copy of this?
It's not part of the record, unfortunately.
Would you conclude it was an exculpatory affidavit? Is that?
It's a situation in which drugs were found within the car. Mr. Mirabel claimed that they were his drugs initially, and the affidavit is one in which Ms. Stafford is saying the drugs are hers. That is my understanding of the affidavit.
Does the state have a copy of the affidavit?
I am not sure if the state has a copy of this affidavit. But
are you and the state able to agree that there is an affidavit and what it says?
I believe that there is an affidavit. I believe we would both agree that it is Ms. Stafford taking responsibility for the drugs that were found within what is noted even by the police officer as a female's jacket. This is crack cocaine.
Excuse me, I'm still a little confused here. Nobody has seen this affidavit, neither the state nor defense counsel?
It's not part of the record.
Right, I've heard that.
I'm coming in late. Because it's not part of the record and I wasn't able to, you know, raise it, I can't be exactly sure if the state has a copy of this affidavit. It was discussed during the Superior Court trial before Judge Brady. It was not made as part of the record.
As I read the record in this case, at some point when the affidavit was being discussed, defense counsel at trial said, I could have had a hearing on this subject, but I didn't have a hearing to address the witness Stafford or the affidavit, and therefore I, defense counsel, think it would be unfair for the defendant to talk about the affidavit.
That is what he said, and that is a statement that underlines where defense counsel was clearly taking actions to the detriment of his client due to the perceived duty. He actually had a duty to Ms. Stafford.
So if he would have had the affidavit, and assuming it says what you think it says, whether or not she took the Fifth Amendment, an argument could be made that it was admissible as an admission against interest.
Correct. Defense could have tried to get it in as an admission against interest. It could have been also presented with the testimony of Thomas Monahan as an investigator, as a statement against interest, as well as for Mr. Monahan to be able to establish the voluntariness of the affidavit itself.
Well, defense counsel, I didn't mean to interrupt, but defense counsel made a tactical decision before trial to waive a Demby hearing and an attempt to get it admitted as a statement against interest, correct?
I believe he did, but there's not a complete record of all the reasons why he did this.
Do we know? Let me just ask a question, then I'm happy to hear what your answer is. But my question is, was he aware of the conflict at the time he made that waiver? Or does the record demonstrate whether he was aware?
First, I would say I'm not sure it was a tactical decision. There, as we read through the transcript of the hearing, the prosecutor gives us a good outline, because the prosecutor was having a consistent dialogue with the defense and believed that there was a conflict of interest in this case and alerted defense counsel to that fact.
Well, it's on the record that apparently the public defender and his superiors in his office also believed there was a conflict. Is it in the record how the representation continued when everybody, including the trial judge, seemed to believe there was a conflict?
I believe that the theory was that there wasn't a need to have Ms. Stafford called. And because the public defender's office was taking the position that there wasn't a need to have Ms. Stafford called.
That was before the defendant said he wanted to call her. So the defendant said, I want her called. He said, I think calling two witnesses are the only way to save my life. And the judge said, do you want to call this witness? He said, yes. The judge said, do you waive a conflict? The defendant said, no. And the judge said, do you want a new attorney? And he said, yes. And as far as I can determine, there was never a ruling by the Superior Court on any of those questions.
The Superior Court basically sidestepped the issue, and I believe their hope was that the conflict never fully materialized, but it did materialize. It actually materialized prior to trial when defense counsel was making or needed to make the strategic decisions of what is the defense that I'm going to be presenting, who are the witnesses that I'm going to be calling and subpoenaing for the hearing. The evolution of the identification of the conflict, it appears that the public defender's office at one moment didn't believe there was a conflict, and I believe that's the rational conclusion based upon the Attorney General's office queuing up for them. I think you have a conflict. I think you may need to get out. But at one point, the public defender assigned to it met with a series of his individuals at the public defender's office, which included two senior high-level individuals and other unnamed individuals. And the quote is, and the final consensus is that it was a conflict of interest. And that's at page 22 of the appendix.
Counsel, you never really answered my question, and maybe the record doesn't demonstrate it. Do we know whether at the time the public defender forewent the Demby hearing, whether he was aware of the conflict?
I believe the most rational reading of the record would be that he was aware of it. He's indicating that he couldn't go down a certain path in his hearing. And that was because of the fact that he knew that he couldn't put his former client on the stand and ask her questions that directly related to the fact pattern.
I'm asking about at the time of the Demby hearing. Is there anything that demonstrates that?
I believe the statements that he's making is indicative that he's recognizing that he's not having the Demby hearing because of the fact of Ms. Stafford and not being able to put himself in that situation where he would be putting...
Where does it say that in the record? It said there was a hearing scheduled before and I chose not to have the hearing. That's Mr. Motoyoshi. And I think it's only fair that he not be allowed to testify regarding that one issue.
Within that direct quote, he's not making an indication of what... all is in his mind at the moment that he's saying it's not fair. I believe that when one looks at the totality of all the statements that were made, and I believe it's mostly between the sections of the appendix that are from A17 through A22, it certainly appears that there is an understanding by the public defender's office that there is a conflict of interest. Whether or not he was aware of the conflict of interest at the time of deciding against the Demby hearing doesn't mean that there still wasn't a meaningful conflict of interest that affected the trial issues.
Justice Holland has pointed out that there was never a ruling on the mistrial, and that appears to be because both counsel told the court that such a ruling was premature, that it wasn't ripe, and that as a result, that with jeopardy having attached, it might prevent a retrial if there were a mistrial. That's why that ruling wasn't made, correct?
I believe that is, but that argument is erroneous. The record was clear that there was a conflict of interest as of that moment. Their stated positions to the court.
Let me stop. I understand it, but that's not really what I'm driving at. What I'm asking is, after that, the judge instructed the defendant not to testify about the affidavit and said, if you want to bring that in, you may have to do it through another witness, presumably Ms. Stafford, and you can talk to your attorney about that. And then there was never a motion made for a mistrial, was there? Post that ruling?
I would agree with you that there was not.
So this is a plain error analysis that we're making?
No, it's not a plain error because it was raised to the court. The court was aware of the conflict, aware of the fact of what Mr. Mirabel's desire was. So it was queued up for the court. But
can you point me to where the error occurs? Where in the transcript?
Well, the court is aware during the dialogue with Mr. Mirabel. As of that moment, the court could have engaged in more conversation to allow that issue to be resolved as of that moment. And if I can have one moment, please. It is on page A17 that's Mr. Modiyoshi's comment. The court conducts an inquiry with Mr. Mirabel as to whether he is willing to waive the conflict. I argue that the reason why the court was choosing those wordings is because the court is aware, as of that moment, what would be a rational defense strategy, present the witness, Ms. Stafford, possibly present a investigator to show the voluntariness and buttress that. The court is directly asking him if he is willing to waive the conflict, and he is indicating he is not willing to waive the conflict. As of that moment, the court had sufficient information in front of it in order to understand that there was no way to avoid the conflict of interest between the public defender's office needing to make decisions from that moment onward about what to do in the rest of the case, which, according to the public defender, were being compromised by what they understood their duty to be to their former client.
But so even though defense counsel as well as the prosecutor said the issue's not ripe, don't rule on it yet, that's the point at which error occurred.
Yes. And the fact that the public defender is saying he doesn't believe it's right, I believe that's an erroneous statement. It was ripe. There was sufficient facts. The facts were in front of the court. The court should have, at that moment, ask the additional questions in order to clarify what was a clear conflict. Just the fact that the public defender was indicating what he couldn't do showed his limitation.
Well, it's my understanding from the record that at that same point in time on the record, and what we knew by way of background is Stafford and the defendant were both in the car when it was stopped. And the defendant was charged with possessing the drugs. His defense was they weren't his drugs, they were Stafford's drugs. And his defense, he wanted to support with Stafford's testimony that they were her drugs, or introducing her affidavit as a statement of interest that they were her drugs. But the court and the lawyers on the record seem to have said, well, we're never going to get to that if Stafford's never called. And the judge said, tell your client he can't talk about the affidavit. So the conflict was addressed by basically saying it's never going to come up because the defendant's not going to get to call Stafford and he's not going to get to testify about the affidavit. Then when the defendant testified about the affidavit, the state started talking about a mistrial. Isn't that correct?
I believe your summary of how it evolved is correct, but the court erred at that moment when they said there's not a conflict, and it is because...
I'm not suggesting anything. I'm just trying to understand the record that your position is the court recognized the conflict and decided to deal with it by agreeing the defense counsel didn't have to call Stafford if defense counsel didn't want to call Stafford, and defense counsel had already said, I'm not calling her because if I do, I've got a conflict, I can't cross-examine her. And then the judge further said, tell your client he can't talk about the affidavit, and defense counsel said, I think it's fair that he can't talk about the affidavit because I waived the Denby hearing on his behalf. So what we have is a defendant whose defense is, I was sitting next to a person and they were her drugs and it's a woman's jacket, and the case goes forward with the inability to present that defense.
That is correct. With the inability to present it either with the testimony of Ms. Stafford, the use of the affidavit, or the testimony of Mr. Monahan, all which would have buttressed the statement of Mr. Mirabel, because putting it in context, Mr. Mirabel, his first statement about the drugs in the jacket were that it was his. The works were was his. He never rescinded a comment. Well, there was marijuana that was found specifically on his person. He wasn't trying to claim that that was someone else's. So he rescinded a certain portion of his statements to law enforcement, but it is only as it relates to the the drugs that were found within the woman's jacket. Justices and Vice Chancellor, I ask to reserve 8 minutes if I can preserve that time for my rebuttal, please.
Very well.
Thank you.
Good afternoon again.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Maria Knoll representing the State of Delaware. Appellant Mirabel cannot prevail on his conflict of interest claim in this case. The public defender's representation of Stafford had ended as of June 4, 2012, more than 1 month before the public defender entered their appearance on behalf of Mr. Mirabel. The public defender's office did not actively represent Stafford at the time it represented Mirabel, nor, because it had simply represented Stafford on a hindering charge, did it have divided loyalties in this case.
Well, help us with the fact that the public defender in this case at trial said, if I have to vigorously cross-examine Stafford, that presents a conflict for me. I mean, it was the public defender who read the rules of ethics on the record to the trial court and said, This whole thing started because he said, my client wants Stafford called as a witness. Here's the rule. The way I read the rule, I have a conflict of interest because I can't vigorously cross-examine her. And then the record proceeds, and the judge says to the jury, we have a very serious legal issue that we're going to have to recess and address. And then the jury, you know, is sent away for a while.
While I understand that, Your Honor, in reading in a strict adherence to Rule 1.7, my reading of 1.7 would indicate that the public defender's office had represented Rebecca Stafford with respect to a hindering charge only and not respect to any sort of drug charge.
No, I understand that, but the hindering charge arose out of this incident, didn't it?
It arose out of this incident with respect to her, I believe, hiding the name of the true name of Mr. Mirabel.
So we've got a person who was seated in the seat in the car next to Mr. Mirabel, and he's saying it's her drugs, and she's charged with a minor offense. I think it was even disposed of in the Court of Common Pleas.
Correct.
But the charges for both of them originate with the same operative fact.
Correct, Your Honor.
So they could have been tried jointly if she had not taken the plea?
I don't see how they could have been tried jointly, Your Honor. There's no conspiracy charge. I don't see how they could have been charged as co-defendants. They have no charges in common whatsoever. Normally, in an indictment, at least one charge is in common if you're going to be charging someone as a co-defendant. At least that's been my experience.
But I thought you acknowledged they were the same operative facts.
Well, they were charged in the same incident. Now, they're also both in different courts, so I don't see how they would have actually gone to trial together at any time.
You can indict on a misdemeanor in Superior Court.
You could, Your Honor. I'm not saying that it can't happen. I've just never seen it happen.
Your argument to us is, on behalf of the state, is there's not a conflict. And the record reflects that the prosecutor at trial, when this all came up, said to the judge, I told him this was a problem. And I told him it was a problem a long time ago and that this was a conflict and they should deal with it. And now they didn't. Here we are, and we're faced with the prospect of a mistrial.
Generally, and I'm sure as Your Honor is aware, whenever we see that there is the potential for a conflict of interest, we bring it to light to the defense attorneys to say, please review to see if you have a conflict of interest here. That is what the prosecutor did in this case. From the record, it's clear, as Mr. Modiyoshi had said a number of times, I reviewed this with my office a number of times, and there wasn't a conflict, and there wasn't a conflict, and there wasn't a conflict. And it was the intent.
I thought they all agreed there was a conflict if Ms. Stafford testified.
I believe on the day that they started the trial, when it became clear that Mr. Mirabal was the one that wanted to call Ms. Stafford, at that point they decided that they wanted to say it was a conflict, yes.
So the prosecutor saw that it was a conflict before the defense attorney saw it was a conflict. Then when the defense attorney finally realized it was a conflict, the prosecutor said, I told you about this a long time ago.
The prosecutor indicated there is a potential for a problem here, yes.
So as of the time of the trial, there was a conflict. Do you concede that?
No, Your Honor, I don't concede that, no. In this case, the public defender indicated he had no intent to call Ms. Stafford.
Well, now, let's set aside the public defender. Let's assume the private counsel had continued. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't the private counsel want to call as a defense witness someone who exculpated his client in an affidavit?
I think it would depend.
I
believe it would depend on each case, Your Honor. In this particular case, we have a defendant, Mr. Mirabal, who had confessed more than twice to the police, specifically claiming that the drugs were his before the police even told them we found drugs in the car.
Well, he had an explanation for that, didn't he? He was trying to protect the co-defendant or the other?
The other co-defendant. He said he was trying to protect Bethany Santana. However, there's no explanation why he knew that the drugs were in the car and where they would be found before the police even said they had found drugs. But we also have an affidavit where Rebecca Stafford is saying that the drugs were hers and that the defendant didn't know that there were drugs in the car.
Have you seen the affidavit?
I have not seen the affidavit, and I was trying to
But we also have an affidavit. What you really mean is we also understand that
we also understand there's an affidavit. Yes, Your Honor. What I had tried to do is I wanted to find.
Excuse me.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
It's important for us to understand this complicated record.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't tell us you have an affidavit if you haven't seen it. So it would be helpful to us if you simply say accurately, it's our understanding or it's represented to us that this is what's in the affidavit. Because if there really is an affidavit and you know what's in it, that may be different.
I understand, Your Honor. The understanding that I have, Your Honor, is that the affidavit from Rebecca Stafford was that she indicated that the drugs were hers and that the defendant was unaware of them. That is from, I believe there were some motions that were not filed because a hearing did not happen.
Can I stop you there? Because I may be oversimplifying this, but it appears that counsel for defendant knew about or understood that there was this affidavit.
Yes.
But defense counsel didn't plan on calling Ms. Stafford.
Correct.
For reasons that are not altogether clear, although I see that there is reference from the state that if the defendant takes the stand, then the state is going to bring up the Stafford situation and the suggestion that she had been intimidated or coerced or something along those lines, and that arguably defense counsel thought better to leave the whole thing alone, make no reference to Stafford, make no reference to the purported affidavit, and therefore have no cross-examination about the possibility that Mirabelle actually was forcing her to write this affidavit. Is that kind of an accurate summary? It may not cover all the points, but is that a fair statement?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, stop. And what we have, if I understand it, is no ability to determine whether that decision made by defense counsel was made in any part because of a potential conflict of interest or because of an actual conflict of interest, or as a strategic decision that was unreasonable and that constituted ineffective assistance of counsel. We don't know either of those things because the record doesn't address them, does it?
It does not, Your Honor.
So don't we have to let this play out as a post-conviction motion?
That is the state's argument, Your Honor, yes.
It appears to me from the transcript that the trial judge was about to rule on the mistrial issue arising from the conflict when the prosecutor said, please don't do that, it's not ripe, and we may not be able to retry. Was that an accurate statement of the law?
I don't believe that's accurate. I believe that had there been a mistrial, the state would still have been able to retry the case.
Well, particularly since the defendant was the one who was in effect asking for the mistrial. Right?
I believe we would have been able to retry the case. I think that was a misstatement.
But in that same exchange, the prosecutor said, please don't declare a mistrial. I don't think there's a manifest necessity for a mistrial that may cause us problems down the line. And the trial judge asked the defense attorney to comment, and the defense attorney said, I agree, meaning I agree there's no manifest necessity for a mistrial.
That's correct, yes.
So given that, what standard do we use to review this decision or lack thereof?
I'm not sure, Your Honor.
Well, as a procedural matter, is there any scenario under which it would be proper for this issue, whatever it might be, to be addressed by this court on direct appeal as distinguished from a Rule 61 motion?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe that this is more properly an ineffective assistance of counsel claim on a Rule 61 as opposed to a direct appeal claim. It seems to the state that what Mr. Mirabelle is claiming is that he was denied his right to effective assistance of counsel due to divided loyalties. His counsel wasn't acting effectively. And that is what he's claiming here. However, he would like to have it addressed on direct appeal.
But didn't the public defender basically say to the trial court that if Stafford was called as a witness, he could not ethically cross-examine her?
He did say that, yes, Your Honor.
So doesn't that also mean that if he called her as a witness and she became hostile, that he could not ethically examine her?
If the defense attorney had called her?
Yes.
I would say that would be true as well, yes.
Well, then, it's either one or the other. So why doesn't that demonstrate a manifest necessity for a mistrial?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe the reasons are clear. I believe it as to why he didn't call her. I believe that it's more logical reading of the record that the reason he didn't call Ms. Stafford was that strategically she wasn't going to benefit his case, and that she was going to, there was a whole host of reasons that she would actually be even more detrimental to his case. And that's, the record is, doesn't support that she would have been helpful. Mr. Mirabals basically said, I just want to call Stafford because I think she's a shot I need to take, and if I can't have that shot, I want a mistrial.
Well, who should be making that judgment call for the defense? An attorney who has a conflict or an attorney who does not?
An attorney who, well, ideally an attorney who does not.
And was that the case here?
The state's position is there was not a conflict. This representation of Ms. Stafford in CCP, I don't believe, caused a conflict. And she, in this particular case, she wasn't going to be testifying anyway.
But does that answer the, does it, is the issue whether there was actually a conflict, or is the issue whether, at least in part, the defense counsel was convinced there was a conflict? The judge, after she told the defendant not to testify about the affidavit, said you can't get it in that way, it's hearsay, you may be able to get it in through Ms. Stafford, you'll have to talk that over to your attorney and make a decision. But the attorney's already said he's got a conflict, he can't cross-examine her. So is that a real choice that the defendant had at that time, or is it an illusory choice that doesn't really allow him to make a decision, or his counsel to make an unconstrained decision about that tactical question?
Well, and I'm sorry if I've read the record a different way, but I thought that the judge had said that it wasn't coming in under hearsay. You were going to have to try and get it in under someone else, and I thought she was indicating either Mr. Monahan or somebody else. I didn't know if she had said Mrs. Stafford.
Well, you're quite correct. She doesn't use that term, but that was the... That was the thematic.
Okay.
That's how I take that statement.
Because at that point I was under the impression that Ms. Stafford had indicated she was taking the fifth, and she was at that point not taking the stand. So cross-examining Ms. Stafford was...
Well, this is the statement.
Okay.
The statements made by Ms. Stafford are not admissible through you because they're hearsay. They may be admissible through another witness based on the law and circumstances. If so, then you and your lawyer can have a discussion about whether he will or won't call any other witness about it. And I'm asking whether, given the fact that counsel, at least, felt there was a conflict that would not allow him to cross-examine Ms. Stafford, that was an illusory choice or a real choice.
I believe that was an illusory choice, Your Honor, and I believe that's something more applicable to being analyzed under a Strickland analysis.
Well, let's go back to the point Vice Chancellor Glasscock asked you about, where it appeared the judge was about to declare a mistrial. And the prosecutor said, please don't make a ruling on the mistrial because there's no manifest necessity for a mistrial that may cause problems down the road. And defense counsel agreed. And you've indicated that both attorneys were probably wrong. Where does that take us?
Well, what I indicated was I didn't think a mistrial, I don't think it would have been wrong that having granted a mistrial, I think the state could have still proceeded at that point.
Right, and let's assume hypothetically that is correct.
Okay. Where do we go from here? The fact that the court didn't grant a mistrial and that the defense attorney didn't request one, what the defendant did request one, the defense attorney did not request one. And that's what we're left with, is determining whether what the defense attorney did was ineffective assistance of counsel. And I believe that's the question.
So since there was no motion by the defense attorney, our analysis is plain error?
Yes, Your Honor.
So what we developed in our exchange is that there was this concern about a conflict and the necessity of declaring a mistrial based on the conflict. The state had concerns that if a mistrial was granted, it wouldn't be able to retry the defendant. And we've all agreed that's probably not the case, that the defendant could have been retried. But the fear of not being able to retry the defendant apparently was the motivating force in the judge's decision to make no ruling on the mistrial application, albeit from the defendant.
Right. The court has nothing further?
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. There was a portion in time when the defense attorney was addressing the court, and he outlined his understanding, and this is on page 821 of the transcript. He described to the trial judge that he advised him, meaning his client, if he chose not to waive the conflict, and that he spoke out in court regarding the affidavit of Ms. Stafford, and then at some point the court might at that point issue a mistrial. Or, if the witness then, Ms. Stafford, called to the stand, then it would create a conflict of interest and new counsel would have to be appointed. And I advise him that if he decided to waive the conflict, and as long as Ms. Stafford waives the conflict as well, then that would not be the case. In making that statement, the public defender is noting two different types of situations that in his mind would create a conflict. One would be if the witness is called to the stand. He's making a determination in which I believe it would be clear from the record that his decision to not call her to the stand would be because of the attorney-client relationship. He describes, and the reason why is, he describes in detail the ethical rulings, that the ethical rules that would identify why there would be a conflict of interest.
I don't know what you are responding to and where you're taking us, but can you do it succinctly?
Certainly. So within his compound comment about what he said to Mr. Mirabel, he's recognizing two situations where there would be a conflict. One is if she took the stand, but the defense lawyer, is indicating he can't call her to the stand. And then the first incident is really something that Mr. Mirabel controls, because it's Mr. Mirabel's statements and whether he is deciding to go down that path of wanting to talk about the affidavit that would create a conflict of interest. There's nothing that...
Well, you agree that the decision to call or not call a witness is for the lawyer to make, right?
That is clearly for the lawyer to make, and that would be reviewable then for ineffectiveness unless there's a record demonstrating that that reason was made for purposes of...
Which gets me to the same question that I asked opposing counsel. Why, on what procedural theory can or should this court entertain this case on direct appeal as distinguished from a Rule 61 post-conviction motion?
Because there is adequate records, adequate statements, adequate evidence to be able to demonstrate that there was dual loyalties by the public defender's office.
That all of that goes to, you could be easily addressed on a Rule 61. What legal doctrinal rule it takes this case out of that practice? Because it sounds like you're trying to shoehorn a Rule 61 motion into a direct appeal.
Well,
tell me why that's wrong, if it is wrong.
I do understand that issues such as a Rule 61, that would come about after someone has exhausted their appeal issues. And in this case, we believe that the record was clear enough of the conflict of interest to be raised on direct appeal.
That's not a legal argument. That is, it's not a procedural argument that it tells this court why we wouldn't be creating a very, very problematic precedent if we agree to decide this case on direct appeal. That's what I'm grabbing at.
In Lewis, the court already recognized that there are situations where the record is clear that there is a conflict of interest, and there is some parallels between Lewis and this case, although in Lewis we had two defendants going to trial at the same time. Here we have two defendants from the same...
Well, tell us what you contend the rule of law would be. Because we would have to write an opinion explaining why, in this case, we are taking what appears to be, to all intents and purposes, a post-conviction claim and deciding it on a direct appeal.
A post-conviction claim would be needed if additional facts were required in order to be able to establish the conflict of interest. There is not a need for an additional factual hearing. And because of that, because our position is that the record is clear, that...
So your argument appears to be that the magnitude of the conflict reflected on the record is sufficient to justify a conclusion that there was a manifest necessity for a mistrial, and that the legal error that we can address in a direct appeal, even on a plain error standard of review, is the failure to declare a mistrial in view of the record conflict.
Certainly I agree with that statement, and that would follow this court's precedent of where it has previously found that a record was clear and required reversal.
Well, in Lewis, we referred to the alleged error related to the effective assistance of Lewis's trial attorney ab initio and potentially undermine the attorney's effectiveness during the entire proceedings. Is that circumstance present here from ab initio?
I would state that it is, and the reason why, as is, the conflict of interest still would have been apparent even if this case would have went to a sentencing hearing. Because the public defender's office, at a sentencing hearing, often you compare and contrast one individual's responsibility with another individual's responsibility. In a case such as this, where Mr. Mirabel is indicating that there is a degree of culpability of a person who is represented by the public defender's office, looking at it, if he's convicted, the public defender's office still would have been conflicted within that type of a situation, because...
So your position is at the initial interview or whenever an attorney was assigned to Mirabel, he would say, my defense is the drugs belong to Stafford. The public defender would have said, who's Stafford? Looked into Stafford and said, well, you know, our office represented Stafford in this hindering charge. So if it's your position that they were her drugs, not your drugs, you're going to need a contract attorney.
Correct, and that would normally have been done early on, but there was an unusual fact pattern here of where the representation of Mr. Mirabel did not occur until after Ms. Stafford's case was fully adjudicated. But that does not still mean that there's not a duty to Ms. Stafford, because of the fact that if Ms. Stafford would have went on the stand and Ms. Stafford would have admitted that the drugs were hers.
Is it clear from the record that the public defender had knowledge of the exculpatory affidavit before the trial began?
I believe it is clear based upon the, including the argument that the state made, that there were pretrial motions filed that would have recognized this Denby issue. So it's clear that the public defenders were aware as of that.
Who filed those, the private attorney or the public defender?
I do not know, although a copy of the docket entries would reveal who did that.
And what's the Denby issue?
The Denby issue would have been in relation to Ms. Stafford's testimony, whether her statements would have been admissible at the trial. And the public defender's office, for some reason, they dropped that.
Why would they not be admissible?
I think they would be admissible. I believe the biggest problem that the public defender's office had would have been a reason to not want to bring those statements in due to the dual loyalties that they recognized that they had.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments. The court will take the matter under advisement, and we will adjourn.